Alma's nails are too dirty for cooking. Your spaghetti con pollo is the best in the land. You are so very different. She rolls her eyes every time you turn on the news and says she cannot stand politics. She brags to her girlfriends that you are, in quotes, a radical and a real Dominican, even though on the Platano Index, you wouldn't even rank a 3.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Neda Ulibi. This week, author Juno Diaz reads from two works, a short story published last year in the New Yorker magazine and his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao is Diaz's second book. The first, a collection of short stories, catapulted Diaz to literary stardom when he was 27 years old. But Diaz then succumbed to a crippling case of writer's block. When he finally published his first novel, which reflected his working-class immigrant Dominican-American upbringing, Time magazine called it astoundingly great. The overwhelming majority of critics agreed. These readings by author Juno Diaz were recorded in September 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. Listeners sensitive to strong language should be aware that we have not edited any of the profanities in the readings or the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Yeah, always. Thank you all for coming out. You guys are so sweet. Oh, it's nice. Spontaneous clapping. That's always good. You don't have to do much for that. Yeah, so D.C. is a very weird place, man. You know, we're in the middle of it right now, so it makes it only more weird, yeah? I always wonder how folks closer to the beast must be weathering this, yeah? I wish, if it weren't so painful, one would say these are extraordinary times, yeah? But unfortunately, the pain attached to these times makes it far less likely for us to be kind of charmingly amusing about it, yeah? I mean, you know, how you guys are close, so you have some insight. What do you see? Yeah? Somebody just said madness, I think. Yeah? Is it really like that?
Yeah.
Ah, deception. Why we like to read fiction, yeah. The sort of fictional narratives of our political parties are so incredibly sloppy that I'm astonished how hungrily people love, I mean, they just devour this shit. But there is no genre writer on the earth who would write as sloppily as these campaigns write. But fuck it. You know, it seems if there's a candidate attached as a population, we have an enormous tolerance for the character's name changing from chapter to chapter. They're like identity changing from chapter to chapter. You know, the setting changing. They're like, oh, we were in the Arctic, you know. And then they're like looking for water. And I think that part of why I find this very important is for any of us who are doing work, intellectual work, cultural work, who are teaching, any way involved with pedagogy, or that most important work of all, of raising children. These are very strange times. To try to explain this moment to anyone, whether it's to your young people, to your students, and probably even more keenly felt to yourself. So this is one of the times I advise everyone, guys, we have how many days? 50 days? 50? I'm telling you, man. You know, everybody knows what they got to do, so then you throw the dice. But what you can do for the next 50 days is keep a journal. Because instead of a journal of a plague year, this is a journal far, far worse, yeah? And I think these records will bear us in good stead no matter what happens one way or the other. And so I really encourage everyone to keep a journal of the next 50 days because I think we will all be struck by how much we will need these insights in the future, yeah? And just an emotional record of what we're going through spares... You know, it spares us the fact that what we're going through will help no one. Yeah? So, yeah, that's what I was thinking on the way over, you know. So I will just read two small bits, and then we will take questions. I write so incredibly slow, I'm stuck reading the same shit for nearly a decade. There's something Borges about this trap, but we have the talent that is dealt to us and no more. You know, that is the great fate. Somebody thinks that was ironic. It wasn't at all. You know, we have what we get. So I'll just read this little piece. It's annoying, but it's short. Yeah. It's called Alma, and it's in second person. Yo, how many people are Dominican? I need to ask this. Oh, shit. Oops, hi. Team A. What was that? Oh, shit. Of course. I'm from New Jersey, so the Heights nationalism is astonishing. Yeah, I was going to tell somebody from the Heights, like, lock the front door. Yeah, no, I lived up there for the last few years, so, but it's an extraordinary place. Yeah, y'all have to tell me how it is to be a Dominican in D.C. Somebody's like, bueno. So, this is the story, yeah? It's called Alma. You, Junior, have a girlfriend named Alma, who has a long, tender horse neck and a big Dominican ass that seems to exist in a fourth dimension beyond jeans. An ass that could drag the moon out of orbit. An ass she never liked until she met you. There isn't a day that passes that you don't want to press your face against that ass or bite the delicate sliding tendons of her neck. You love how she fights you when you bite. You love how she fights you with those arms that are so skinny they belong on an after-school special. Alma is a Mason Gross student, one of those Sonic Youth comic book reading alternatinas without whom you might never have lost your virginity. Grew up in Hoboken, part of the Latino community that got its heart burned out in the 80s, tenements turning to flame. Spent nearly every one of her teenage days on the Lower East Side, thought that it would always be home. But then both NYU and Columbia said no, and she ended up farther from the city than before. Alma is in a painting phase, and the people she paints are all the color of mold, look like they have just been dredged up from the bottom of a lake. Her last painting was of you, slouching against the front door, only your frowning, I had a lousy third world childhood, and all I got was this shitty attitude, eyes recognizable. Alma did give you one huge forearm. I told you, she said, I would get the muscles in. The past couple of weeks, now that the warm is here, Alma has abandoned wearing black and started wearing these nothing dresses made out of what feels like tissue paper. Wouldn't take more than a strong wind to undress her. And when you see her on the street flaunting, you know exactly what every nigger that walks by is thinking because you are thinking it too. Alma is as slender as a reed. You are a steroid-addicted block. Alma loves driving. You love books. Alma owns a Saturn. You have no points on your license. Alma's nails are too dirty for cooking. Your spaghetti con pollo is the best in the land. You are so very different. She rolls her eyes every time you turn on the news and says she cannot stand politics. She brags to her girlfriends that you are, in quotes, a radical and a real Dominican, even though on the Platano Index, you wouldn't even rank a 3. You brag to your boys that Alma has more albums than any of them and that she says terrible white girl things while you fuck. She's more adventurous in bed than any girl you've had. On your first date, she asked you if you wanted to come on her face or her tits. And maybe during boy training, you did not get one of the memos because you were like, neither? Yes, yes. It's an opposite attract sort of thing. It's a great sex sort of thing. It's a no thinking sort of thing. It's wonderful. Wonderful. Until one June day, Alma discovers that you are also fucking this beautiful freshman girl named Lakshmi. Discovers the fucking of Lakshmi because she, Alma, your girlfriend, opens up your journal and reads. Alma waits for you on the stoop, and when you pull up in her Saturn and notice your journal in her hand, your heart plunges through you like a fat bandit through a hangman's trap. You take your time turning off the car. You are overwhelmed by pelagic sadness. Sadness at being caught, at the incontrovertible knowledge that Alma will never forgive you. You stare at her incredible legs and between them to that even more incredible popola that you have loved so inconstantly these last 2 years. Only when Alma starts walking over in anger do you finally get out. You dance across the lawn, powered by the last fumes of your outrageous sinvergüenzería. Hey, muñeca, you say, prevaricating to the end. When Alma starts shrieking, you ask her, darling, whatever is the matter? She calls you a cocksucker, a punk motherfucker, and a fake-ass Dominican. She claims you have a little penis, no penis, and worst of all, that you like curried pussy, which is really unfair, you try to explain, since Lakshmi is technically from Guyana, but Alma is not listening. Instead of lowering your head and copping to it like a man, you pick up the journal as one might hold a baby's beshattered diaper, as one might pinch a recently benutted condom. You glance at the offending pages. Then you look at her and smile a smile your dissembling face will remember as long as you live. Baby, you say, baby, this is part of my novel. And this is how you lose her. Thank you. Yeah. Somebody's like, brilliant. You know I'm paying those cats for that.
When did you write that?
I wrote that like 2 years ago. Why?
There's an impersonator out there who is acting like him.
I am deeply troubled. You know? I am deeply troubled. Well, no, I mean, one of the great values of... look, guys, one of the things about the going to a big state school, one of those big box schools. Yeah, I went to Rutgers. Somebody's like... Yeah, one of the things about that is that it turns into, like, infidelity madness. Yeah? Because if you go to a school where there's, like, 2,000 students, the level of, like, surveillance and gossip is extraordinary. But when there's, like, 40,000 fucking students, people just get up to no goddamn good, you know? It's extraordinary, you know? I mean, I spent 4 years at Rutgers, and I never once dated somebody who knew the person that I was dating before, which is impossible at a school like where I teach, MIT, you know? And so... part of my project, of course, is trying to write stories based on the madness of a place like Rutgers, you know? So I'm just going to read a small piece again. Somebody just said page number. This is a very demanding audience. I refuse to reveal the page number. On truculence alone. Just because I'm belligerent. Yeah. No, that's going to be page... 51. Yeah, I'm a big wuss, yo, when it all comes down to it. Before, like, 10 years of failure entered my life, the amount of, like, rage that I had and my willingness to, like, just fight anyone for the minimalist reasons was sort of absurd. but, you know, there's nothing like failing for a decade at doing something you really think should be important to your life to give you some choices. And one of my choices was to grow the fuck up, you know? It's like I would have probably jumped off a building if I didn't. And part of growing up is you become a big wuss, I realize. Yeah. So Wildwood, yeah, it's from the novel. And here goes. It's never the changes we want that change everything. This is how it all starts. With your mother calling you into the bathroom. You will remember what you were doing at that precise moment for the rest of your life. You were reading Watership Down, and the rabbits were making their dash for the boat, and you did not want to stop reading. But then your mother called again, louder, her "I am not fucking around" voice, and you mumbled irritably, "Si, senora." Your mother was standing in front of the medicine cabinet mirror, naked from the waist up, her bra slung around her like a torn sail, the scar on her back as vast and inconsolable as a sea. You want to return to your book to pretend that you had not heard her, but it is too late. Her eyes meet yours, the same big smoky eyes that you will have in the future. "Ven acá," she commands. Your mother is frowning at something on one of her breasts. And for the record, your mother's breasts are immensities, one of the wonders of the world. The only ones that you have seen that are bigger are in nudie magazines and on really fat ladies. They are 36 triple Ds, and the areolas are as big as saucers and as black as pitch. And at their edges are fierce little hairs that sometimes your mother plucks and sometimes she does not. These breasts have always embarrassed you, and when you walk in public with her, you are always conscious of them. After her face and her hair, her chest is what she is most proud of. "Your father," your mother likes to brag, "could never get enough of these." But given the fact that he ran off on her, it seemed in the end he could, yeah? You dread conversations with your mother, those one-sided dressing downs. You figured that your mother has called you in to give you another earful about your diet. Your mother's convinced that if you eat more plátanos, you will suddenly acquire her same extraordinary train-wrecking secondary sex characteristics. Even at that age, you were nothing if not your mother's daughter. You were 12 years old and already as tall as she was, a long, slender-necked ibis of a girl. You had her green eyes, clearer though, and her straight hair, which makes you look more Hindu than Dominican, and a behind that the boys have not been able to stop talking about since the fifth grade, but whose appeal you do not yet understand. You have her complexion too, which means that you are dark. But for all your similarities, the tides of inheritance have yet to reach your chest. You have only the slightest hint of breast. From most angles, you are flat as a board. And you are thinking that your mother's going to order you to stop wearing bras again because, in her words, they are suffocating your potential breasts, discouraging them from developing. You're ready to argue with your mother to the death because you are as possessive of your new bras as you are of the pads that you can now buy yourself. But no, your mother does not say a word about eating more plátanos. Instead, she takes your right hand and guides you. Your mother is rough in all things, but this time she is gentle. You did not think her capable of it. "Do you feel that?" she asks. At first, all you feel is the heat of that tissue, is the heat of her and the density of that tissue, like a bread that has never stopped rising. She kneads your fingers into her. You're as close as the two of you have ever been, and her breathing is what you will remember. "Don't you feel that?" Your mother turns towards you. "Coño, muchacha del diablo, stop looking at me and feel." So you close your eyes and your fingers are pushing down and you're thinking, of course, of Helen Keller and how when you were a little girl, you wanted to be just like Helen Keller, except a little more nunnish. And then suddenly, without warning, you do feel something. A knot just beneath the skin, tight and secretive as a plot. And at that moment, for reasons you will never quite understand, you are overcome by the feeling, the premonition, that something in your life is about to change. You become lightheaded. You can feel a throbbing in your blood, a beat, a rhythm, a drum. You do not know how or why you know this thing, but that you know it cannot be doubted. It is exhilarating. For as long as you have been alive, you have had bruja ways. Even your mother will begrudge you that much. Hija de Liborio, she called you after you picked your tía's winning lottery number for her, and you assumed Liborio was a relative. That was before you started going home to Santo Domingo, before you learned about the great power of God. I feel it, you say, too loudly. Lo siento. And, like that, everything changes. Before the winner is out, the doctors remove the breast that you were needing, along with the axillary lymph node. Because of the operations, your mother will have trouble lifting her arms over her head for the rest of her life. Her hair begins to fall out, and one day she pulls what's left out and puts it inside of a plastic bag. You change too. Not right away, but it happens. And it is in that bathroom where it all begins, where you begin. That's all. Thank you. Reading is a bizarre thing, yeah? Sort of like reading from your own book is like trying to give an impression of who you are as a writer or what your project is, like trying to get an idea of a movie from that little TV guide blurb, yeah? So it's all nonsense. I thought I would take some questions. Oh, what is my definition of a nigger? I don't think I have any other meaning than the one that, like, U.S. society taught me. I have, like, no spin on it, you know? Some people have figured out ways to put an extra spin or to have some extra meaning to it, but I never have, you know? It's kind of a strange word for me because it's my relationship to nigger began when I immigrated to the United States and not before. So at 6 years old, I suddenly discovered a new word that would victimize me for the rest of my life in many ways. I'm not Black American. I'm of African descent from the Dominican Republic. And yet people felt incredibly free with using this word and its many variations. Depending on what time of day it was, I was either a nigger or a sand nigger or a half nigger or all sorts of other weird things. And therefore, the question for me about definition is always more of a question of relationship, is what do we do as artists with words that have victimized us and that victimize other people? What is our relationship to this? And what do we owe to representation, despite our kind of pain, you know, which is very complicated, and every artist has to make a decision about that. And I think the most useful strategies tend to be the decisions that a whole bunch of artists decide. You know, it's never one person's strategy that works. It's the necessity that we have for multiple strategies. So, I mean, that's how I think about it, you know. Yeah. Madame?
Hi. I read your book in a book club, and actually one of the questions that we had as a group was, how much of Oscar Wilde is autobiographical? Hmm. You break the line between author and reader and narrator a lot with the footnotes. So I was just curious if you would be willing to reveal that.
No, of course. This was the book I wrote so that I could happily say nothing in this book is autobiographical. Yeah? I mean, truly, it was my dream after my first book that I could just be like, no, I don't know any of these characters. I made them all up, you know. There's an entire, I don't know how to describe it, there's an entire group of young Dominicans, young Latinos, young people of color who come from poor or working class backgrounds who are like super intelligent, super bookish, super nerdy. And I feel that end up going to college. And I feel that they're like, no, I feel like they're invisible at the level of like national representation, at the level of popular narrative. They're entirely invisible. And so I wanted to write about this group because it's part of the group that I grew up in. And I thought it was so weird because I know all these kids I went to college with, either state school or at Ivy League school, and they're cats from these backgrounds. And you don't get into Cornell because you were like stabbing your teacher, you know? But my experience when I went to Cornell, it was surreal. My experience was all these cats that I knew at Cornell who were, swear to God, they were the ill thugs of the world. And I used to go to my room and like giggle myself to sleep, you know? Because I left dudes in my neighborhood who would slap the fucking taste out of these cats' mouth and then proceed to eat a burrito, you know? And the distance between the masculinity that all my nerd friends in college were performing from the fact that you had to be a nerd to get into college, it struck me as something incredibly useful. And I wanted to use that personal material as sort of the basis. But the characters themselves, all of them are made up, you know? Yeah. Sorry.
If it's not autobiographical, what's your connection to Demarest?
Well, no, I mean, autobiographical, of course, it's set in New Jersey. And it's, I can't imagine not writing about New Jersey, you know? And it's set in the Dominican Republic. I'm from both places. And I attended Rutgers University, and I lived in Demarest. But use of setting is in no way imply that it's, like, from my life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I... You know, I lived in Demarest for 2 years. Are you a Demarest person?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the, it was a lot of fun for that reason.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys, you can't enjoy it that way.
Oh, wow.
But anyway.
How compassionate. So, anyway. Oh, very compassionate.
Sorry.
Thank you.
I've been a fan of yours for, I guess since Drown came out, that was one of the books we read in my English literature class in college. And I guess I was just struck tonight at how I'm experiencing your work in a very similar way, but not experiencing sort of the packaging of you in a similar way. We spent a day in my discussion class talking about how it takes 15 minutes to get through the blurbs in Drown. There's like 18 quotes from the literati on the back. I saw you at the Folger Shakespeare Library a couple years after that. You were a little better behaved at that end. I like you the way you are now, but I think, I guess what is in common to me with that is sort of this almost sheen on your early persona. And I guess with three blurbs and you being very real tonight, I experience you differently. And I guess I'm wondering if you can comment on how you feel like you were packaged before and after, if that is relevant to you.
Yeah. But I'm just wondering, could you restate, though? And come on, guys. You guys are terrible, yo. I'm being very serious, yo. I actually want you to restate the question because I feel like you're not really asking me your question, and I don't really understand it. I'm not playing dumb. I just really want to know what you really want to know, what's your question. Be as direct as possible.
I guess it's, I would imagine that in how your book was packaged early on, it was sort of... the way that you behaved at the reading, you were very polite. You read your work. I met you. You were very, like, nice to meet you. I didn't really hear, like, you know, hey, what the fuck? What's going on, you know? and maybe it's just a different event. But I'm wondering if you feel more free, perhaps, since your earlier successes, to be more authentic to how you are, or if that was always authentic to you.
Wow, it's so funny how these events get interpreted very differently. Because... I got an 8-page letter from someone in the audience at that exact event telling me that I should never have been allowed there.
Oh, cool.
Because all I did was curse and act out, and it was total disrespect, not only to my other readers, but to the the concept of the Folgers Library into writing in general. You know? So
I was so disappointed. I wanted more, maybe. I was so disappointed. I think I was expecting more of it or something. I don't know.
But I guess that... I think it's... I think we have to be very careful about these things. I don't know what people expect from a person who locks himself up as a writer, locks himself up in a room for, like, large periods of time. And, you know, it's... Look, we're not simulations of ourselves. We don't reproduce ourselves exactly every single day. You know, the very fact is that we have plenty of nuances and we're different people depending on what moods they are. You know, I mean, I think it's always such a it's something that we often forget, because we're in a society that demands that we be who I think you should be every time, and not that you should be allowed all sorts of room to move around. As far as the idea of packaging a book, look, I do literary fiction. They don't make any money off of me, and I don't make any money off of them. All of this applause for winning an award and for writing this book hasn't changed the fact that I drive a used car. I have a friend who's a popular writer, and he said, and I'll never forget this, he said, yeah, I sold 5 million copies of my last book. That changed my life in every way. You're still living in the same crappy fucking apartment. People keep saying, has this changed your life? He's like, doesn't look to me like it's changed it at all. You know? But I think it's something that we should remember, is that corporations will do anything to get someone to pick up a book. You know, they're in this for a fucking business. If they could figure out a way to put an x-ray of my broken skeleton in there so that they could get people to pick it up, they would. You know, and I've never felt any... I never felt less or more free vis-a-vis publishing, vis-a-vis events. My sense of myself is, of course, flawed because I'm speaking of myself. But from what my friends report, I tend to be the same gloomy, crabby, cursy, you know, just kind of lame, you know? So I don't know. I don't feel as if anything seems to have any effect on it. You know? But again, that could just be madness, you know? So
I'm not trying to call you out on your Hollywood comment, which I hope is not a thinly veiled insult to the latest Batman movie, but I did want to...
Am I going to get beat up because Batman was an hour too long?
But I'm a big Hemingway fan, and I did want to ask about this book's relationship to The Brief Happy Life of Frances McComber, and if you could comment on how that book or that story influenced this book.
Well, I mean, one of my obsessions is concepts of masculinity, yeah, concepts of love. And that's a story that is about very traditional concepts of, like, I just felt like the conflation of Oscar Wilde, who's someone who was destroyed because of his own misreading of the society he was in, vis-a-vis love, and the short happy life of Frances McComber, someone who questions of masculinity and questions of love were central to the story. It just felt like a perfect title given what I was dealing with in the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the use of Spanish in your book, because you're so careful when you write and you take so long that you probably picked out exactly where you want to put those Spanish words in. And you know, I was in this blog the other day, and somebody said that they read it and that they didn't speak Spanish, so they couldn't understand part of the book, but that they didn't care because the rhythm of it. And I don't know, I think it's just perfect the way it is. But I just wanted to ask you how you pick, you know, when you put Spanish in and when you don't. And I found it interesting that you have really long footnotes about Dominican history, but no translation of the Spanish words. So just
yeah. Well, no, I think that's a really great question. Again, they say when you're working on a long project, you're basically building a language, yeah? When you're working on a novel, you're creating a language from scratch, the one that you're going to use for the book. And so how much Spanish, when to use Spanish, what kind of Spanish, was project specific. the kind of Spanish and the kind of tools that I had to use for my first book did not apply for the second book. I had to recreate a totally new set of codes and a new exchange system for this book. Each project seems to sustain a certain amount of linguistic overload. And in this one, the linguistic overload felt very high to me. And where you choose to put them, how much you choose to put them, is determined actually by the work itself. The more that I wrote, the more I found myself getting a better sense of how to do it. So by the end, I had to rewrite the whole thing from the beginning, because by the end, I felt that's when I finally had an idea of what in the world I was doing. You know, what's the rhythm? What do I need? How much? What's the energy? Yeah. I mean, the footnotes about Dominican history weren't actually there to teach you anything about Dominican history. It seems kind of, I apologize. To me, it seems kind of like a bad idea to learn history from a novel, but, you know, actually, they were there more, they were there more to address a larger issue of textual authority. You know, like how we as audiences respond and require certain kinds of authority. And I thought it was fascinating that Junior's authority in the historical sections was often unquestioned and generally accepted when almost all of it was wrong, you know. But because it's history and it comes with the sort of aura of legitimacy to begin with. But Junior's discussions and his insights on science fiction and fantasy, because they're considered frivolous genres, is almost left entirely unexamined. But he's utterly dead on there. And in fact, Junior's arguments about genre in the book are more useful for reading the book than any of the stuff about Dominican history. Though, of course, you can get you can enjoy the Dominican history. Everyone can read the book the way they want to, but I knew for a fact that if you paid attention to the history, you were going to lose what was really happening when Junior was talking about Andrew Norton and talking about the Watchmen, and that there was something else happening in that place where we just think those words are just bells and whistles.
I was on my way to work this morning, and in the express there was a small notice that there was this event this evening, and so I thought about it all day, and I came for that reason. I'm from Texas. My wife is Dominican, and I have 4 Dominican American children as a result. And for us in where we live, there aren't a lot of anything. If it says Dominican, you pay attention because there aren't very many. And my kids are always sort of, and my wife as well, they're sort of oddities. And what I was interested in fact I didn't know this was going to happen today, but you're going to be in Dallas, I believe, next week, next Sunday, I think, and we have tickets to, I'm taking my whole family to see you speak there, and we've seen you on on YouTube and such.
It's a new world, man. Yeah. It's a new world.
Thank you. And I have a child who's 13 at the moment, and he's going through difficult times, and I'm sorry. I think he found inspiration in what he saw in your speaking, and my wife as well. And earlier when you admonished the group to, sort of do the right thing, and the last thing I think you mentioned had to do with raising children. And for the first time in my life, I went to the Dominican Republic this past summer, and I love it. I love my wife, and I think I love things Dominican, but then I find out it's really her, and it's really people, and it's individuals, and she has a huge family, and it turns out I like a lot of them, but I don't like a lot of them, I'm at the point where I said, people are people, but I was also, frankly, it was depressing because there is a from my perspective, and I have a very limited, you know, experience. I'm not literary. I don't know much. But I there was a tremendous, from what I gather, there's a what is racism that exists in the Dominican Republic in a very different way than here, but it exists. My wife, because she's Latin American and we're in Texas, you meet people who are Mexican American, you meet people from all over the world, and it's like it's everywhere. Everyone has it. And having kids, my question would be, do you see hope for it being any different?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Look, the thing is that from my very narrow perspective of what we're looking at here is that we do what we do, whether it's raising children or writing books, because we believe without question that things can get better, whether it's the local thing of your own life and your own family, whether it's the larger cultural issues. I think that in the sense that without that feeling of hope, there's no reason to have children and there's no reason to produce art. You know, it's this utopian promise that the pieces that we are will be put together in a better way in the future that keeps us going. My sense is I believe wholeheartedly that things will always get better. Are we subhuman, predatory animals to each other? Without a doubt. Have we created absolutely demonic systems that are keeping us totally screwed in mind, bodies, and soul? Without any question. Are we going to do better than this in the future? More likely than not, we will. Will we also do worse? Never any failure of that. We're good at doing worse, you know? But overall, I just believe things are going to, they're not going to be all right, but that as a race, we've seemed to have as much of our badness as countered by our willingness to believe that things can get better and by working for that. And so I do believe things will be much better. Unfortunately, as with all things in human beings, we're going to have to fight for it like animals. If I think about my ancestors, they used to be bred, you know? I mean, I spent like, my genetic code spent 500 years being bred as an African slave to be a worker with no rights to who I could love and no rights to the disposition of my children, with no ability to enjoy, to understand, to embrace, to celebrate my own labor. And, you know, a good portion of the planet still lives under similar conditions. But if anyone escapes from those conditions, there is in that escape the promise that one day we can all escape. That it won't just be individuals, you know? But we'll take it from this side and then...
Sure. Real quick, I taught English to all boys for a couple of years and kept telling them to keep their voice, keep their voice, keep their voice, as I made them read, you know, the classics. And I don't think they ever could find it. But how your voice is so unique, I think that's probably what grabbed a lot of us, so real in language. Did you find resistance? How did you break through it? Or were you like, you know, fuck it, this is who I am? And did you ever struggle? Because it's so, for me, it was so fresh. Your imagery was amazing, and then you brought it right down.
I guess, thank you. Unless you grew up in a world where your voice was always valued and your experiences were always expected to be the foundation of great art, you're going to struggle to find your voice. You're going to struggle to find the worth in your material. You're going to struggle to understand that, that kind of mundane specificity of who you are and what you've done is in some ways the code of the universe. And I think that, of course, there's always resistance. Anyone who doesn't... look, guys, to be an artist, to be an author, means that you want to try something new. And as most of us know, the new tends to get kicked first before it gets embraced. So, I mean, God, I always tell my students, I'm like, why do you want everybody to love you in this workshop? That means you ain't doing anything fucking new. chances are the people who are the most talented are the ones that we're all going to like write off and be like, you're not dope. So, yeah, no, I've lots of resistance. I'll just take both of these questions. Yeah, just say them and then I'll answer them together. And we'll call it a good night, guys. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my question. I'm from Patterson, and we dated boys from Don Bosco. And my sisters are going to be very disappointed to know that it's fictional, because we swear we know all your characters.
Well, but no. I said that it's not from my life, okay? It's not autobiographical.
So maybe we do know them.
It's not autobiographical, which is different from it being entirely fictional, yeah? My best friend is from Don Bosco.
Yeah? Is that why you... Well, my question is, you just read this short story, and I know them too. And I'm wondering, do you choose, as an artist, do you choose not to separate yourself from your North Jersey Latino-ness because you think there's a lot to write about it, or is it something you can't do? Like, it's the way you see the world, and you can't separate from it.
Well, in my mind, I think that anyone who argues that they can't sell a part of themselves misunderstands what it means to have agency. There's always an opportunity for you to sell yourself. And there's always a temptation. That's what being human is, you know? The question for me is more that I've made it the center of my project, that I think the center of the entire universe is Dominicans in New Jersey. You know, I think that I really, honestly, I've said this before in my head. When I imagine my own version of Star Trek, I see every one of the characters is like Dominican, you know? I mean, it's the same shit. White people think of themselves in Star Wars. They're like, everybody's white in Star Wars except for the aliens. I'm like, fuck it. In my Star Wars, everybody's Dominican, you know? And so, but part of this comes just from straight up anger of everyone always dismissing where you're from. I mean, being from Central New Jersey, you might as well be from the least known part of the United States as far as New York City is concerned. And it breeds inside of you either a desire to represent or a desire to like pretend you're from New York. And for me, I chose to represent. Yeah. So. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.